And joining us now is Austin Evers, who's the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog and top Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration. He served most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Austin Evers.
Thanks very much for having me.
So in terms of having oversight over the Trump administration, of course, the biggest investigation into Trump and his activities in terms of his election in particular is the Mueller report. It was much anticipated. And to my mind, it's the Republicans have done a pretty masterful job through William Barr of blunting its impact, muddying the waters, and confusing the public to the point where it's not entirely clear what is in the report, let alone how to proceed investigating the threads and leads that Mueller has provided because of the obstruction on the part of the White House in terms of subpoenas. So let's start with that premise. Do you agree that they've really been successful in today's hearings? Were again a display of essentially obfuscation and obstruction, where the Republicans ask questions about Hillary Clinton's emails and the Democrats try to get Barr to talk about what appears to be a letter from Mueller, critical of how Barr had spun the findings. And again, they obfuscated.
I think, I put it this way. I hope that the jury is still out on the final outcome of the Mueller investigation, what Congress's investigations will turn up, and ultimately what the American people will decide happened in 2016 and the fitness of this president to continue in his office. There's no question in my mind that Attorney General Barr has been, frankly, masterful in his distortions. He started with his four-page summary, but don't call it a summary letter, describing the principal conclusions of the Mueller report. He sent that out over a weekend. It is not a fair reading of the Mueller report at all. And in fact, we learned that Mueller responded almost immediately with a letter that can only be read as a bureaucratic version of a temper tantrum, frankly, that the letter was not true to the report. And then he appeared today in Congress unrepentant that he misled the American public. And bottom line, I think we are out of chapter one of this saga, and the next chapter is going to be Congress really taking accountability up on its own and not relying on Bill Barr to be its savior.
So why do you think they are so zealously and skillfully covering up for Trump? Surely some of these Republican senators know what's going on with the misrule and the criminality and the contempt of the rule of law. I mean, the extent to which Barr joined in that by being sort of critical of the FBI and the DOJ and suggesting that maybe they should be investigated would indicate to me that they're all sort of buying into that idea of blaming the investigators rather than looking at what the investigation has found.
It feels like politics. I'm not sure that there's another explanation for it. And I guess I come down on this just fundamentally disappointed, although maybe not surprised, on two fronts. From Congress's perspective, I don't think it matters what party you're in. You should stand up for Congress as a co-equal branch of government that is part of our system of checks and balances. And when you get evidence, even if you don't think it is, beyond a reasonable doubt evidence, and when you get evidence that the presidency is out of control, that it's obstructing justice or taking acts that look like obstruction of justice, you should buy into the idea that Congress has a role to play. And what we saw on display from many members of the Senate, and I bet we'll see it tomorrow too, is that many members of Congress are willing to throw out their institutional power in service of politics. What troubles me about what Barr has done is that he has used his reputation as an institutionalist. He has wrapped himself in the legitimacy of the Department of Justice as George H.W. Bush's attorney general and used that in service of misrepresentations and deceit. That makes it more damaging. He's not acting as just a partisan. He is turning the legitimacy of the Department of Justice into a tool for partisanship, and that's going to leave scars that are going to take a very long time to heal.
And again, I'm speaking with Austin Evers, who's founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog and top Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration. He served most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency Matters. And of course, the irony here, Austin Evers, is that we already saw how investigations that are entirely political can have a damaging effect, although clearly in terms of the phony Benghazi investigations, of which there were about 8 or 9, I might add. You recall Hillary Clinton was able to spend hours and hours batting down this absurdity, and they didn't really lay a glove on her. But nevertheless, the Republicans invested heavily in that. This is what's so strange. This isn't actually a real investigation carried out by Republicans about something that's real, not imaginary. And in a way, the Republicans are now sort of trying to equate it with the Benghazi investigation, even though they wouldn't admit that. They're basically saying this is a political witch hunt, not a genuine investigation. So I find it sort of the cynicism rather breathtaking.
It is breathtaking, and it's new. So if you look back at the Benghazi investigations, I was there. I served in the State Department during those investigations. There was a lot of criticism about Trey Gowdy and the Republicans launching a select committee, that, you know, the 9th or 10th investigation of Benghazi. But you know what? Their Democratic counterparts in the House of Representatives, they agreed to serve on the select committee. They participated. They did not question Congress's power to conduct oversight. And the executive branch may have made complaints to the press about the legitimacy of the investigations, but you know what? They didn't contest the legitimacy of the power behind them, and they turned over thousands of pages of material, hundreds of hours of testimony. What you're seeing today is obstruction coming from within Congress, which is unprecedented, and a degree of obstruction from an administration that is also unprecedented. Frankly, it shows that, it's possible to break this system, and it's going to be incumbent on probably Jerry Nadler and Elijah Cummings, two chairmen in the House, to escalate. Because right now, what oversight that had been based on norms and trust and the Constitution isn't going to cut it. You're going to have to probably go to court.
Well, but at the end of the day, we already have an instance where the Secretary of the Treasury has effectively broken the law, because the law is really clear about if the House Ways and Means Committee want anyone's tax returns, they have to be handed over. And if they're not, there's a penalty. I think it's $10,000 and some jail time. Clearly, Steve Mnuchin is violating the law. But what do you do? Do you send the Capitol Police over to arrest him?
There's a lot of theoretical debate about what Congress can do to enforce its power. If you look back to the 1800s, it did arrest people. It has tried to fine people in the past. I think what you're seeing right now is those ideas coming back in response to the escalations of this administration. It shouldn't be a surprise. I think the most likely outcome right now is not going to be a return to sending out the Capitol Police to the Department of Treasury. I think we're going to see the Congress going to the third branch of government, the courts, to enforce its powers. And I know lots of people think that the courts have been stacked, that they are political, but they are bound by precedent, and the precedent is quite strong on Congress's oversight power. So they're going to have to tee up some of these fights, and maybe the end result will be court orders that the Trump administration actually has to comply with.
Well, certainly if the Congress wanted William Barr to fulfill the legal requirement and arrest Steve Mnuchin, after today's hearings, I wouldn't put much faith in Barr being anything but a protector of these people as opposed to standing up for the law.
It's pretty clear that we shouldn't expect Bill Barr to put the Constitution over allegiance to the administration. But, in all frankness, the Republicans in Congress used to complain about Eric Holder and how Eric Holder wouldn't enforce their contempt motions. We need to fix this. And we need to get to a point where when Congress is exercising its legitimate oversight powers, that its only recourse isn't to a political appointee of the president, or that there's at least a good faith response from that political appointee. I actually think a lot about the attorney general who came into the DOJ after Watergate. His name was Edward Levy, and he made it his mission to restore the legitimacy of the Department of Justice in the constitutional system, in the minds of the public. And he did it by acting above and beyond in good faith. And I think we need someone in that office, regardless of party, to do that. Bill Barr is definitely not that guy.
So was there anything in the Barr hearings today, Austin Evers, that you thought really did pull over Barr? I noticed that Kamala Harris appeared to stump him, or at least he simply couldn't answer or didn't want to answer her question.
Bill Barr definitely had problems asking direct questions that skillfully attacked the premises of his deceptions. I thought Senator Harris did a good job of asking him whether he had reviewed the underlying evidence that supports the Mueller report. Of course, the answer is no. Of course, he didn't do that over a weekend. The key part of that, the key outcome of that questioning is that it tees up the legitimacy of a congressional request for that evidence. You know, you don't, a jury doesn't rely on a prosecutor's closing argument to reach a verdict. It relies on the evidence presented at trial. And I think Congress is making the argument it needs the underlying evidence. The thing that really stuck out to me, though, about Bill Barr today is the number of times he really revealed his role in being Trump's defense lawyer. At one point, he imagined what Donald Trump's defense lawyers would say to an argument. That's not his job. Well, I mean, he's not quoting them. He's imagining them. He's playing that role. It was astonishing. And then the other thing that he did, which was deeply troubling, was that he repeatedly mischaracterized evidence. He invented rationales that could have been in the president's head, for example, when he directed Don McGahn to fire Mueller. Barr was reaching for potential other explanations for what was in the president's head. We don't know. We know that Mueller said there was substantial evidence to find that that was an obstructive act. And the reason that we can't conclude what was in the president's mind is that he refused to talk to Mueller about it. Bill Barr went way out over his skis to provide a smokescreen for the president, and it was astonishing.
So what did you think of Senator Mazie Hirono's questioning? Because she seemed to really put him on the spot, and in fact, at the end, the chairman, Senator Lindsey Graham, came to Attorney General Barr's rescue, saying that he'd been slandered by Senator Hirono.
Well, I would certainly disagree with Senator Graham's characterization of Senator Hirono. I don't think that Senator Hirono was slandering Barr. I think she was using his own words to demonstrate that he had a serious negative impact on the public. He had mischaracterized what Mueller said, and he has whitewashed what obstruction of justice is. You know, I think it is entirely fair for people like Senator Hirono and maybe your listeners to conclude that Barr's not a straight shooter. And I think it says a lot when Lindsey Graham, the chief defender of scoundrels, comes to your defense.
Well, Mazie Hirono accused Barr of being the chief defender of, quote, the grifter and liar who sits in the Oval Office. Now, I've been guilty myself of describing Trump in that way, adding to the possibility that he's also a traitor. So to that extent, I'm sympathetic, and I'm glad that people are talking about something real, because essentially the decorum that one expects from a president has been broken by the incumbent. So I don't think there's any point in pretending that we can normalize this man. But why is Lindsey Graham doing it? And my understanding is that he, in fact, said so, because he was his trenchant critic as long as his friend John McCain was alive. But the minute that John McCain died, suddenly Lindsey Graham becomes Trump's best friend and biggest defender. And his only explanation that he's hinted at was that about re-election, that if you're a senator and you don't think about, or you're not primarily concerned about your re-election, then you shouldn't be in the business. And that seems to be the explanation. That all of these people on the Republican side who one would normally expect a little bit of decency from are essentially worried about being primaried or having the Tea Party Trumpsters come after them. But at the end of the day, it's maybe 30, at best 40% of the country. So my question to you, Austin, would be, What's wrong with the 60%? Why is the 60% of this country putting up with this disgraceful behavior?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with the citizens of this country having a difficult time parsing what's going on. I mean, Bill Barr contributes to this. He created a lot of confusion about what Bob Mueller found. He made it sound like, what did Trump call it? Total exoneration. And then 3 weeks later, you get a 450-page report saying anything but. If the American people don't have a clear understanding of the severity of the evidence in that report, it's not their fault. It's the fault of people who are obscuring, who are deliberately obscuring it. And I think it is important for public servants to stand up and speak the truth, be clear, be angry when it's appropriate. And then I think it is also appropriate not just to judge someone like Lindsey Graham from the perspective of his, whether he's changed over the years. I'll let him speak to that. But again, his title is senator. He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And a lot of what he's doing right now is undermining the institution. I mean, he's questioning his colleagues' authority to conduct oversight in ways that they're anti-constitutional, they're anti-Congress. And you would expect, at minimum, a senator to jealously guard the power of his office.
Well, of course, Lindsey Graham admitted that he hasn't even read the full report. But just in closing, if the Republicans have successfully obfuscated, muddied the water, and blunted the impact to confuse the American people, as you've made clear, and there's no question that that's happened, how do we get clarification? How do we get the American people to really focus in simple, straightforward way of what that report's really about and what should be done about redressing I can't even call them crimes, but the accusations and evidence in that report?
I think it's just unfortunately true that justice is slower than falsehoods. I mean, Mark Twain said that a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on in the morning. And that's just always been true. So the answer to your question of what can we do to get the truth out there, the answer is time. And I hope that Congress and the media and groups like American Oversight and your listeners spend the next weeks, months, maybe even longer, bringing this report to life. I don't think, if you can't count on the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee to read the entire Mueller report, you can't count on voters in Missouri to do it or voters in Texas to do it. We don't have the time. People don't have the time to do it. So we have to bring it to life. It's time to bring Don McGahn in to testify. It's time to bring Sarah Sanders in to testify. It's time to ask Bob Mueller if he disagreed with Bill Barr. It's time to stop letting Bill Barr be the mediator for what is true and what is not. He's clearly lost that right. So we need to have more patience. Look at how long it took us to get to this point with Mueller. Now we have all of this amazing evidence in front of us. We need to digest it. And maybe I'm naive, but I will trust that in the end, the public will digest it and recognize what is true, what is false, what is bull, what is real.
Well, Austin Evers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Austin Evers, who's the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog, and the top Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration. He serves most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency Matters. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a further analysis of Barr's testimony today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, the president of the American Constitution Society and the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director for NARAL Pro-Choice America. And during the Clinton administration, she served as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. And she's the author of the new book just out, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Caroline. And what did you make of the hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where William Barr seems to have continued his campaign of blunting the effect of the Mueller report and muddying the waters? And, of course, the Republican senators joined in a chorus of obfuscation, trying to steer the questioning away from Trump's ties to Russia and obstruction of justice to questions about Hillary Clinton's emails.
Well, I mean, it just confirms what we already knew, was that the attorney general has decided he's not the attorney general. He's Trump's private attorney. You know, Trump had said at one point, you know, where is his Roy Cohn? And Roy Cohn, the famous mob lawyer who'd do anything to defend his client, even breaking the law. Well, it seems like that's what we have with this attorney general. He seems to know no limits in misleading Congress, in misleading the public, and contorting the evidence to defend Donald Trump from very significant charges of obstruction and conspiracy.
Well, as it happened, Senator Mazie Hirono actually nailed Barr on that, saying he has sacrificed his reputation, quote, for the grifter and liar who sits in the Oval Office. And she accused Barr of behaving as Trump's lawyer, saying he lied to Congress, and she called on him to resign. That, to me, was one of the stronger moments, if you will, along with Senator Kamala Harris's questioning, which totally floored Barr. He simply couldn't answer.
Well, that's right. I mean, they caught him up in his outright lying. And the fact, I think, Senator Harris did a great job of exposing the fact that Barr hasn't actually even examined the evidence. He came to a conclusion, contrary to what Bob Mueller concluded. Bob Mueller said, I'm not going to make a decision about obstruction because essentially you've told me that the Justice Department can't indict a sitting president, so I'm going to leave it up to Congress. Despite Bob Mueller finding 10 instances of very significant obstruction and signaling directly that Congress should take this up, Barr said, there's no obstruction. I'm going to take it on myself. There's no obstruction. And by the way, after being questioned by Senator Harris, we know that he didn't even bother to look at the evidence. It's just, you know, I have to say, it's appalling. It's, this is really a situation which is worse than Watergate. I mean, let's remember that Watergate involved some bungling burglars. I mean, it was a terrible thing. And there was it was uncovered a lot of aspects of President Nixon's behavior that were sleazy and somewhat criminal. But here we have, you know, the participation of the Trump campaign in efforts to affect the 2016 election, that were in fact successful at affecting the election, and then a huge cover-up that consisted of a whole lot of lying to Congress and efforts by the president to get people, his most senior people, to lie themselves. And then we have the attorney general who basically says this is all okay.
Well, I can see that, you know, Lindsey Graham, for example, he admitted that he didn't admit this was why he was being so craven and supine towards Trump after being a critic of his as long as his friend John McCain was alive, and now he's his best buddy. He suggested that a politician who wasn't concerned about re-election shouldn't be in the game, and the assumption is that the reason he's become such a Trumpster is that he wants to get reelected in South Carolina next November, or November in 2020. So that is the conventional wisdom that excuses Republicans from their outrageous behavior and lack of patriotism, I think, is the best way to put it. Can you find any other reason for it? Not that I want to excuse them, but on the other hand, I'm trying to understand why I mean, Lindsey Graham actually complained about Mazie Hirono saying that she was slandering William Barr. I mean, what does Donald Trump do every day, for God's sake, you know?
I know. Well, you know, I think there is certainly truth to the fact that Republicans are running scared because they're afraid of being primaried. And that if Donald Trump calls out his attack dogs and goes after somebody, you know, they may be in danger of losing their reelection. But I think this is obscuring two other important aspects. One is that William Barr has been a Roy Cohn lawyer for a long time. He's got a history that was ignored in some degree by Democrats, to a huge degree by many in the elite media who thought, well, he looks the part, right? He's got the right degrees, and he was the attorney general before, and they forgot to look at the memo he wrote to Trump, the 18-page memo saying, here's why I should get this job, because I don't think you can ever be indicted when you're president. His history as embracing this extremist idea of the unitary executive, which says the president is above the law, which he confirmed in that memo. His history of letting the Iran-Contra people get off the hook of obstructing other investigations. It goes on and on. He was accused by William Safire in the early 90s when he was covering up in the Justice Department then as being a crooked prosecutor. And William Safire was no liberal. But so I think, you know, number one, the story about Bill Barr was not really told well. The Democrats didn't do a great job of getting this out. And he was just, you know, he looked like a less crazy person than Jeff Sessions. But in fact, he's not. He's worse in many ways, more craven, in fact. And the other part that I think I'd also think people need to remember is that the Republican Party has been moving in this direction for a long time. And even though Trump really embodies the worst of it, he is really the more of the public, allowing the public statements that have been privately held. And the fact that Republicans have been engaged in voter suppression, gerrymandering, flooding our campaigns with money of plutocrats and oligarchs, playing footsie with dark money. You know, this is and let's we can talk about the racism that has been, you know, infecting the party. I think we just need to remember Donald Trump is not the only one, and he's not so powerful that he's dragging everybody along behind them. He's actually representing a viewpoint that has been just growing and growing in the Republican Party, and it's just really a frightening moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, the president of the American Constitutional Society and the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director for NARAL Pro-Choice America. And during the Clinton administration, she served as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs and is the author of the new book just out, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. So if Lindsey Graham is being so craven because he's worried about Trump's base coming after him and priming him, and that's the excuse that normally sort of reasonable Republicans, at least those that used to be the stewards of our national security and were concerned about foreign threats like Russia, who now are turning a blind eye to the malign activity of Putin, that's still about 30% of the country, or maybe let's say 40%. So my question to you, Caroline, would be, what's up with the 60%? Why are we being beaten by this kind of thuggish dishonesty that's going on? And that, frankly, they've done a good job of muddying the waters about the Mueller report. They've actually blunted its impact by confusing everybody. And the public really hasn't got a clear picture yet. And now they're piling on trying to stop the Democrats from actually getting these witnesses to clarify what's actually in the report. Because what Trump is clearly afraid of is the only time that they really nailed him was with Michael Cohen's testimony. And Trump does not want any more television testimony. He doesn't mind what happens behind closed doors in depositions. But he sure as hell does not want the public to have people like McGahn and Mueller testifying about what they really think, you know, without Barr's spin.
Well, Ian, you're totally right. And this is sort of the crux of my new book, The Democracy Fix, which, you know, the major premise is that You know, on the left, we progressives, we like to talk a lot about policy and we can debate the nuances and minutiae of different proposals. And on the right, they focus on power. So, you know, in the past, you know, you can see a White House counsel's office that's going to, you know, really think about all the different ways they can kind of limit their production and, you know, fly specking it and all of that stuff. And, you know, in the Donald Trump world, they just say, no, we're not doing it. And, you know, I don't suggest that people on the left should be sleazy like those on the right, but we need to be as equally hard-headed about power, because we'll never win if we spend all our time debating policy, because guess what? You can't implement policy when you're not in power. So I know we can talk about that later, but, you know, with respect to, you know, with the testimony, that sort of goes to the heart of it. You know, Democrats, you know, didn't play enough hardball when Barr was nominated, you know, talk about his history of complicity in cover-ups, of letting the Iran-Contra perpetrators off the hook, you know, of other efforts to protect presidents against wrongdoing, and his audition for this role with Donald Trump. You know, moreover, I mean, his position of the unitary executive is so outrageous and so contrary to the Constitution and our history that basically says, you know, the president can do no wrong. L'État, c'est moi. You know, I think that's what the revolution was actually fought over. And so this culminates in this extreme resistance to the appropriate role of Congress, which is to exercise its checks and balances and oversight. And, you know, when the president is the king, Congress has no role. And, you know, so I think the Democrats need to start fighting harder. You know, there are a couple of avenues. You know, the most obvious, I mean, certainly there's contempt. That's a slow process. There's not going to be criminal contempt because that would be enforced by the Justice Department. And we know that's not going to happen. Civil contempt is through the court system and it's slow and painful. And there's also, you know, there's a historical option of using the sergeant at arms in the different houses to arrest people who resist a subpoena, are in contempt of Congress. That's a kind of politically interesting, maybe problematic. But there's the appropriations process, and they need to start looking really hard at, you know, let's cut this line item. You know, why should the president have a plane? Why should, you know, they need to think, you know, really aggressively. And then I think they maybe do need to think about using the their contempt powers to actually have people arrested. If it comes to that, again, they need to think about what the cameras are going to look like, and there are elections coming up, so I think there are, you know, issues that need to be carefully considered. But enough kid gloves here. You know, Barr should never have been the Attorney General based on what we knew already.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned earlier about his predecessor. The one person you forgot to mention is Matthew Whitaker, who's really lowered the bar, not to make a pun, you know. So,
yeah.
So let me ask you that. You mentioned about the intention of the founding fathers, and of course, the intellectual spark of the revolution came from Thomas Paine. And he said that the king may be the law, but in America, the law will be king. And that is clearly the intention of, and of course, you know, people wanted George Washington to be king, and he resisted that emphatically. But what it's almost like maybe we should bring back the American Revolution.
Well, you know, it might come to that, unfortunately. I mean, I do think if we have an increasingly unrepresentative government, which happens when the president's above the law and when the congressional districts and the state legislative districts are so gerrymandered that, you know, the majority of people aren't represented anymore, which is what the Republican Party is trying to accomplish. You know, you get to a position, you know, especially when they've taken over the court system, to where you have a whole set of entities, our government that's supposed to be democratic that no longer is. People then start to think there's no other avenue, but, you know, some kind of resistance that's stronger than going to the ballot box when that doesn't work anymore.
Well, not to belabor the American Revolution analogy, but we had a mad king back then, George III, and arguably the guy in the Oval Office doesn't necessarily have all of his marbles intact.
Yes, it's absolutely true.
So,
no question.
So out of the gate, the Democrats have to win about 8% more votes nationwide just to break even. And given that we have a minority government, we have the tyranny of the minority, and I mentioned this earlier about asking rhetorically, what is wrong with the 60%? Why do you think people are not sufficiently alarmed at the grifter and liar in the White House, as Senator Mazie Hirono describes Trump, and the real possibility that he is a traitor, that we know that he was helped by the Russians. The Mueller report make that clear, even in spite of what Barr says, that there's no collusion. The report makes it real clear that the Russians wanted him elected. They helped elect him. And we don't know whether they're going to do it again. We don't even know whether this president of ours is actually still taking his orders from Putin. This is the most extraordinary situation you could ever imagine that this country is in. And yet I get a feeling that a hell of a lot of people in this country who aren't happy about what's going on simply do not know how bad it is. So whose fault is that?
I think there are a couple of things here. One is that people are facing some real existential problems that they are really worried about, but that also come back to Donald Trump. So don't forget that, people really rate healthcare as being something that they're really anxious about. And they're worried about Donald Trump, killing the Affordable Care Act and taking away hard fought health care gains. They're worried about the impact of a bad economy on people who are on the margins. And so, sure, the wealthy are doing pretty well. And allegedly the economy is doing pretty well. But, if you look at the polls, people don't actually feel that way. People think that the tax cuts, and they're right, benefited the wealthy extremely, as well as corporate America. And then actually, I think if you look at the polls, you also see that people really think the president is a liar. They disagree with the president on immigration in the vast majority of people think he's mishandled immigration. And so what I think it comes down to, Ian, is that, people are a bit scared or dismayed about whether they can actually make a difference and whether their vote matters. And so they're worried about those other things, and they're worried about the president, and they distrust the president. But because we have gerrymandering and because we have vote suppression, a lot of people may not participate because they think that either it'll be hard for them to vote or their vote won't matter. I think we have to tackle that because as much as I talk about in my book, The Democracy Fix, how we need to address the infrastructure of elections, have get rid of gerrymandering, use nonpartisan redistricting commissions like California has embraced to great effect. But we also, we can't neglect getting people to vote. So it's not enough to fix the systems. You actually have to, get them out. And so, it has to be robust voter engagement and voter turnout efforts, because just because you have a really easy voting mechanism, if people aren't using it, there's not going to be a difference. So I agree with you that we need to do more to reach those people. But I guess I'm more optimistic. I think that they're quite concerned. And the question is, can we persuade them that voting and participating are a way to address those concerns?
Well, Caroline Fredrickson, again, I thank you very much for joining us.
Ian, thank you again. Please know that it's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, the president of the American Constitutional Society and the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NAREL Pro-Choice America. And during the Clinton administration, she served as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. And she's the author of the new book just out, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Caracas, Venezuela for an update on the May Day demonstrations following yesterday's call by the opposition leader for the military to turn against the Maduro government, which so far has not happened. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, a journalist who has covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And you're at a demonstration today. There are demonstrations on behalf of Juan Guaido, who the 60 countries, including the United States, recognize as the head of Venezuela. And there are also demonstrations in favor of Maduro, the incumbent, who still has some support, although he's deeply unpopular. Our Secretary of State has said today that military action is still possible. What's the mood on the ground there? Is there any sense that Guaido's call for an uprising, if you will, is actually working? What's your sense, being there on the ground?
Well, I think that the mood is still very defiant, despite what many thought was a defeat yesterday. People have gathered in several spots throughout Caracas and also throughout the country. A lot of these protests or concentrations have also been dispersed by the National Guard and other security forces. But what I keep on hearing is that people will remain in the streets and that they will continue to support Guaido in whatever Guaido instructs people to do. The latest that he has called on his supporters to do is to consider joining what he's called the Progressive Strike. So this would be each, like, different sectors going on strike until basically the whole country grinds to a halt.
But my understanding is that what he was calling for yesterday was for the military to rise up against Maduro, and particularly the top military brass. And is there any indication that that is happening?
No. Actually, there's absolutely no indication that more military will be joining Guaido. What has happened is that, there's general discontent throughout the armed forces, but this seems to have been quashed. And it certainly is not being played out in an overt manner. It's hard to tell what goes on in the military. But, you know, like I said, I think that it, what appears to be the case is that there's a widespread discontent. Whether this will translate into greater defections is unclear.
Well, my understanding is that the head of SEBIN, the intelligence service that is largely feared, I understand, Manuel Ricardo Christopher Figueira, has defected, and he's made a public letter calling Maduro and his cronies rascals and rogues who are looting Venezuela while its people are starving. Is that an explanation for how Leopoldo Lopez was released from house arrest?
It could be. I would be speculating. To be perfectly honest, I don't know. It seems to me that, you know, that Lopez has a wide support base. I mean, he probably was able to somehow convince the people that were holding him under house arrest to release him. These people are under an incredible amount of pressure, not only in their personal lives because of the economic crisis that the country is facing, but also from sanctions, targeted sanctions on behalf of the U.S. It's a complicated situation, and it's especially when it comes to the security forces here, it's incredibly unclear. They're very secretive, and it's certainly a very sort of tightly sealed institution.
But there were reports that the head of SEBIN, the intelligence service, Figueira, was arrested. But my understanding is that he's not under arrest, that he's written this public letter denouncing Maduro and his clan as a bunch of rascals and rogues looting Venezuela while its people starve. You'd think that might have some effect. So if the head of the intelligence service is joining Guaido, is there any indications that's made a difference?
Not at this point, not yet. I mean, certainly, you know, counting with the support of the chief of intelligence is a huge move. But on the other hand, the fact that, you know, that yesterday there was no mass desertion and certainly no other security forces seem to have joined in also points to the fact that Maduro is still, you know, in power. And it's basically what we've seen. What we saw instead was that Lopez sought refuge first in the Chilean embassy and then in the Spanish embassy. So, you know, it's unclear, but for now it seems that Maduro is still, you know, in control.
Well, our Secretary of State made a strange remark yesterday where he said that Maduro had tried to flee to Cuba and that the Russians had stopped him. Any evidence that that happened and any reports on that? I know there's no freedom of the press left in Venezuela. The government controls most of the media. But what's your understanding about what Pompeo is talking about?
It doesn't seem to be accurate. Maduro denied this. You know, I'm saying that you can trust everything that Maduro says, but I also don't think you can trust what Pompeo says. I think this is sort of a stage, you know, sort of psychological war between both parties. I certainly haven't seen any confirmation or any statement from the Russian government other than calling for, you know, a Pacific, not transition, but a Pacific dealing with this crisis and, you know, for pulling their support behind Maduro. So, you know, I wouldn't say that this is necessarily accurate. And like I said, there was certainly no evidence that this had been the case here.
Well, you never know when, you know, in these situations, what's going on behind the scenes, right? We don't know what kind of discussions are going on amongst the top military brass, and presumably having the head of the intelligence services defect to Guaido may be having some kind of an effect. But there are also military bases around the country, so it's not inconceivable that there may be defections outside of Caracas. But is there any indications that that might be happening, or that at the very least the top military brass are considering their options?
Like you said, I think, you know, that it's probably fair to say that there are negotiations taking place. I don't know what the content of these negotiations is. And it's also undeniable that the country is facing its worst economic crisis. Nobody can be happy at the way that the government is conducting the affairs of the country. You know, we're facing nationwide blackouts, or the oil production has plummeted, and oil is the one resource that we rely on for all of our income. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there has to be discontent in every single institution and along all ranks. The military do not escape the crisis. Nobody does, to be perfectly honest. You know, these are people that are facing medicine shortages for ill relatives. So, you know, again, I can only imagine that Maduro is under an incredible amount of pressure, but I don't have strong evidence that this is the case. But what we saw yesterday is that there was a small show of support of the military for the opposition. We also saw Leopoldo López violating house arrest, which is clearly very significant. But this didn't translate into a change of power or even into, you know, a mass defection across the country. Today is the May Day celebrations here in Venezuela. Traditionally, the president addresses the country, and we haven't seen that either. So clearly, you know, this is a very fluid, volatile situation. But it's all happening behind closed doors at the moment.
Right. And you mentioned earlier, Virginia Lopez, Leopoldo Lopez, very much the political mentor of Juan Guaido, first tried to seek refuge in the Chilean embassy and is now under protection of the Spanish embassy in Caracas. So he must be fearing arrest. That's pretty obvious. But is there any sense that within the Chavistas, the old regime of Hugo Chavez, that there are some loyalists to the revolution who consider Maduro has ruined the country? The evidence is manifest. Of course he's ruined the country. And if you got the head of the intelligence service, who I think was a Chavista, was he not, saying that there are a bunch of rogues and scoundrels looting the country, would that indicate that there may be a way to get rid of Maduro, not by replacing him with Guaido, but replacing him with a Chavista?
Yes. I think that's a fair assessment. And we're in a situation where anything can happen. And like you said, there have been, high-level critics or high-level members of the Chavista government, certainly the old regime, criticizing Maduro vocally. There was also, we saw a couple of months ago, how the chief of the former chief of intelligence came out, not only denouncing Maduro, but also revealing pretty damning accusations about links with, you know, Hezbollah and even drug trafficking allegations. But, you know, this hasn't translated in regime change for some strange reason. So, like I said, you know, it's all up high up in the air and very unclear and difficult to predict.
Well, but it's not clear to me. It's certainly not clear to me, but I'm wondering how it appears from you in Caracas, Venezuela, Virginia, that the Americans are being particularly helpful. Pompeo is, you know, talking about military action still being possible. He made that remark about Maduro trying to flee to Cuba and being stopped by the Russians. And he hinted that the Americans have warned him in some way that they've sort of intimidated him, but he didn't go into details. You've got Bolton sending out his own messages and Pence sending his own messages. None of them, by the way, are in Spanish. So I don't know why they think the, you know, addressing the Venezuelan people in English is particularly helpful. My understanding, well, let me get your opinion, or you're there. My sense is that the Venezuelan people don't want to be liberated by Trump, and they don't necessarily think that's a good idea. From your position, how do they feel about what our government here is doing?
Well, I think the sense is that there has been a lot of talk and no trousers, so to speak. You know, this repeated mantra of all options being on the table has worn thin. And I think that, you know, it's proven to be a lot of empty rhetoric. Having said that, I assume that, you know, there's a great percentage of the population that is feeling greatly relieved, because the last thing you want is a U.S. intervention. You know, there's a long tradition of that kind of policy in Latin America, and it's always played out pretty disastrously. So, you know, I think we all would want this solution to come from within Venezuela. But in a country where all institutions have been sequestered, it's also difficult to imagine how that exactly would happen. You know, we're now facing two prominent opposition leaders potentially being incarcerated. We're not seeing negotiations. We're seeing more and more threats. So, you know, it's, you know, one thing is what we all would like to see happen, and another thing is how feasible this is under the current circumstances.
But that's not to say that Juan Guaido has been arrested. But do you think he will be arrested? Is there any indications that Maduro has said that he's going to punish those who brought forth this attempted coup? Is that your expectation, that he'll move on Guaido? Because the impression that Pompeo was hinting at was, if you move against Guaido, we'll do something which we've warned you about. And whatever that is, I don't know what it is. It's, you know, maybe some Buck Rogers spy weapon that'll come out of nowhere and zap him. Who knows what Pompeo's talking about? But what's happening there on the ground vis-a-vis Guaido? Are you still with me? We've lost a caller back.
Hi.
Hi, yes, Virginia. We lost you for a second. So just to wrap up here, any indications that Maduro is moving against Guaido?
Guaido has been basically in hiding. He's made public appearances today, but, you know, he's not walking about in the, you know, popular corner as he has in the past. I think he certainly feels that yesterday's threats are credible. It would also seem to me that Maduro might move into him, just because otherwise he, you know, would appear to be somewhat weak. If he does, I think that the U.S. could potentially, you know, follow up on their warnings to Maduro that they would find that intolerable. But yes, you know, the fact, I think, like, you know, not only Guaido, but the fact that Lopez has sought protection in the Spanish embassy is certainly indicative that, you know, they're concerned for their well-being.
Well, we don't know what the U.S.'s threat is. We know they made the threats not to go after to Maduro, not to go after Guaido, but we don't know exactly how they're going to back those threats up with action and what kind of action they plan. But just in closing, though, you could never tell with these situations where things are going. And you said the situation is very fluid, because, for example, in Algeria, you know, eventually the people, after months and months of what seemed like futile demonstrations, they got what they wanted. They got rid of the dictator, who was in this, their case, a vegetable. But more dramatically, of course, in Sudan, the professionals, they call themselves, managed to get rid of this horrible dictator. Not sure what's going to replace him, but that's the nature of these people power driven rebellions. But just to be clear, since there are demonstrations both for Guaido and for Maduro today, particularly in Caracas, is there still support for Maduro?
He can still mobilize a very small support base, but he has the support of the military. And I think in a situation like this, the fact that he controls the weapons is definitive. Guaido has a vast majority of the country behind him, but unless, he somehow can manage to rally the support of the military, it will probably be a prolonged wearing out of this crisis. I don't know what's going to give in first, if it's going to be Guaido or if it's going to be the whole nation. I think underlying this whole political crisis is the dire economic and social crisis that the country faces, and one for which there doesn't seem to be any possibility of recovery unless there is a different president that can access the international markets and that can have the possibility of getting loans from, different banks and loan agencies.
And getting,
Maduro certainly cannot have access to those.
Right, and stop the boycott on the oil, which is their main source of revenue.
Correct.
Well, I wish you all the best, and I hope you and your family are able to stay safe. It sounds like a very difficult situation, not on top of the fact that there's food and medicine shortages and hyperinflation and constant blackouts. There's also a sense of personal security, which has never been good in Venezuela. It's always had a high rate of violence. But when you've got the possibility of some kind of civil war, that is not a very comforting situation. So my best wishes to you, Virginia.
Thank you, Ian, and thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.